Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our season two sponsor, Springwise. Springwise is the global ESG innovation platform that offers its readers early access to the ideas transforming our world. I actually started using Springwise probably 10 years ago to review innovative startup ideas, and I've been a fan ever since. There are three new stories on the site every weekday featuring solutions to some of the biggest challenges we face as a global community. You'll find innovations in climate tech, renewable energy, plastic alternatives, the circular economy, and how we can live a more sustainable life. The stories are sourced and written by the Springwise team of journalists and will give you an inspiring take on what's right around the corner, whether you read it to inform your work or simply for a regular dose of optimism. Springwise sets the innovation agenda. The newsletter is free to access, and to sign up, visit springwise.com/newsletter-signup. Author and director of Circle at Stanford Psychiatry, as we delve into her groundbreaking research and advocacy in the intersection of climate leadership, emotional well-being, and community resilience. Britt Ray, leveraging her expertise in science communication, ignites meaningful action in a world grappling with climate change. From acclaimed books like Generation Dread to her podcast Gen Dread, she empowers individuals to confront climate grief and cultivate courage. Drawing from her multidisciplinary background, including a PhD in science communication, Britt sheds light on innovative strategies to address the psychological toll of environmental degradation, such as the creation of Circle at Stanford Psychiatry. As a distinguished speaker at TED and the World Economic Forum, she amplifies the urgency of climate action and advocates for inclusive community-driven approaches. Britt Ray inspires a new generation of climate change makers, envisioning a world where emotional well-being and environmental sustainability align seamlessly. Get ready to be inspired by Britt Ray's passion and commitment to make a positive change. I hope this conversation leads to ideas that you can bring in towards your business or your life, and enjoy the conversation. Britt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marco. Hi.
So this is an interesting one today, because we are going to talk about really a lot around kind of education, awareness, learning, and really no better person to speak to you around this, around climate anxiety and you know, messaging and how this is all having an impact. But before we kind of get into your work and the things that you do, How did you get into, you got into the sciences, and I'd love to just understand your background there. How did you kind of make that jump into climate, and how did you weave that into, you know, schooling and into career?
Sure. So way back in my undergrad days, I was studying biology, and the focus I took in that degree was really conservation biology, which means that you're pretty much learning about the sixth mass extinction day in, day out from your professors. And there's naturally a lot of tie-in and connection to the climate crisis, which is making the biodiversity crisis worse in many respects. So I had my care and concern lit wild, you know, from the age of 17 when I started that degree. And it was certainly informing the way in which I look at the world, and felt anxious about the destabilization of ecosystems based on human activities. So that wasn't really new, but it did come alive for me in a new way many years later, after I had gone through, that science degree, and then went to art school for a master's, and then did a PhD in science communication, and was working as a science communicator, making radio and television programs and writing books. And then I got to a point where I was quite a lot older, and I was exploring with my partner whether or not we wanted to try and get pregnant, which we very much did. But I was spending my days in concerning climate data as a climate communicator, and noticing the lack of effective action And basically, you know, just always hearing that we have until 2030 to have our global emissions to have a 50% chance at averting irreversible climate catastrophe, according to the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then just seeing our emissions continue to go up. And I became filled with a lot of outrage and distress, which was new compared to my prior teenage climate and biodiversity concerns that came from my education. And I just thought, wow, okay, if I'm feeling this because of this reproductive concern, wondering what world I'd be putting our kid into, and feeling like power holders have kind of left the building or not actually upholding their end of the deal and being responsible, aligning with the science, maybe there's more to look at here. Maybe I can turn my climate communicator brain in on the problem and study the distress I was experiencing and seeing if other people were going through it in different, unique ways, according to their own vulnerability to climate impacts and sociodemographics and all kinds of things. So that started the research for a book called Generation Dread, which is about the rise of climate anxiety in our society today, which has become, unfortunately, a pretty mainstream thing out there. But we weren't yet having a conversation around it in 2017 when I started this research for this book. But really, what I discovered over the years of interviewing people for that book and reading everything I could about the relationship between climate change and mental health, I just discovered that there were so many massive gaps that needed filling in our understanding of how to protect and promote mental health and well-being in the most vulnerable communities that are already on the front lines of the climate crisis, but also especially our young people who have to deal with this generationally, cleaning up a crisis that they didn't create. And that's what led me to then overhaul my career. At the time when I was starting this book, I was actually, because of my PhD, I was pretty focused on this field called synthetic biology, and I ended up leaving that and coming to come more squarely into this new field of climate change and mental health. But I wasn't a mental health professional. I didn't have any public health training, and I knocked on so many doors. Eventually, I did convince some folks to allow me to come get postdoctoral training at Stanford University in the global health program so that I could start contributing to this new field, but at a very Wild West time when it didn't exist just a few years before, and we were anyone in it meant that they were kind of pioneering it and helping to create it. And so after that training experience, I ended up having my feet firmly planted in the ground, and here I am now. I work in the Department of Psychiatry in a medical school and help to create this field with others all around the world, and basically co-create and evaluate interventions to protect mental health in our warming world.
Wow, and I guess at the time too, biodiversity, there's obviously, you're probably right at that kind of timing when all of those kind of large reports on biodiversity loss were just being kind of published, I believe, too.
Yeah, there certainly it was interesting because the kind of climate anxiety sensor that I felt within myself was moving through many other people at the same time because of landmark reports that were coming out and hitting the headlines, as you mentioned. A big one you might remember in 2018 when the UN IPCC report came out outlining the difference between a world at 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming and 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which really woke people up to the massive meaning that's baked into every fraction of a degree of warming, because entire ecosystems get lost between 1.5 and 2. You know, it's the difference of having healthy coral reefs or not, and that sort of a thing. And it really just shook many more millions of people awake to the fact that this isn't just a far off crisis, or for people far away who you'll never meet. It's here now, accelerating, and it has really concrete outcomes on the world as we understand it. So yeah, I would say it's all about it's about a climate of emotions, which is really widespread. And it's not only anxiety. There's different forms of distress that might look like outrage at the injustice. That's a huge part of the climate crisis. You know, who's making it worse? Who's being hit hardest and first, and how unequal those things are, as well as outrage at corporate malfeasance from fossil fuel companies and greenwashing and the history of lying to the public about the dangers of the greenhouse effect and so on, or grief about coastlines that we call home that are being lost to sea level rise, let's say, or different aspects of cultural traditions that are withering away with the destabilization of certain environments, or anticipatory grief about losses that are baked in, or, you know, for some it's fear or panic, and for others sometimes it's just a sense of helplessness, like, I'm only one person. This is all so big. What can I really do to be effective here? Or hopelessness and despair. So we see a lot of uncomfortable emotions that people are reporting as they face the climate crisis. And there's a lot that can be done to meet that and help build agency and a sense of collective efficacy and being able to attach to gritty forms of hope that build meaning and purpose in our lives. But often people need to be supported on that journey. And if we remain quiet and alienated in the distress, which many people do because we don't have social norms to process this stuff, it's not really easy dinner table fodder or something you bring up at the water cooler at work, then we feel more isolated and like the weight of the world is on our shoulders alone and it worsens the distress. But actually, you know, if you pierce that damaging bubble of silence and bring it out into the open and it gets validated, people feel a lot better, a lot quicker, and then can find community supports and solutions to be a part of.
You wrote the book Generation Dread. How did you get that started? Was that through school? Were you finishing school at that point? Were you within working with Stanford? How did you go from kind of idea to publish?
I was just wrapping up my PhD. So finally getting, you know, some more space to imagine focusing on something other than that thesis. And as I mentioned, it was really a big thing in my personal life at the time that my partner and I were wrestling with this question of trying to get pregnant, which just happened to coincide with that moment when I was wrapping up the PhD. And so then I was able to start the research looking into what are the psychological impacts of the climate crisis. Like, we hear so much about technology and science and policies, but what about the human side? What about the heart-centered side? What about, you know, the ways in which this shows up in people's nightmares and ambitions and, you know, fears about the future, but also a sense of love for this planet and other people and the more than human world? Like, why aren't we having that? The humanities of global warming, writ large for us yet. So, I basically then was freelancing and just trying to make ends meet, doing different public broadcasting gigs and getting a book proposal together. And then TED conferences and TED Talks ended up taking me in. I was a resident there and they incubated me as I created the book proposal for Generation Dread and kind of got my ideas together. And then got a book deal after that, and then was able to start writing. But I wasn't at Stanford yet. That happened a little bit further down the line because it was really the journalistic project of discursively exploring these ideas that made me realize, oh no, like we are woefully unprepared to deal with the mental health and psychological impacts of the climate crisis. Because, you know, I've now interviewed lots of, yes, mental health professionals and climate scientists and government officials, policymakers, ancestral wisdom holders, activists, parents, like all kinds of different people to weigh in on this issue. And they all say, like, we are just not ready to deal with the scope of distress and trauma that the climate crisis is introducing and that is coming as a tidal wave unless leaders make deep-seated changes to how the climate is protected faster and more effectively than it has ever really been done before. And so we need all hands on deck. And it's fine that you don't have a history in this field. We need to build it together. A lot of us don't have a history in this field because it's not yet a field. So let's come together and just get working. And that was kind of my invitation to figure out how I could do more than just journalistically look at it, but start researching too and bring the academic piece to match.
And when you publish the book, I guess a question around your audience, who is your audience, or who did you think your audience was, and did that change once you published the book?
Those are good questions. Yeah, I mean, I think in retrospect, I can see very much that I was writing the book that I needed to read at the time, but I wasn't setting out to read it for any particular audience other than I wanted it to be a support to people who were feeling distressed, struggling with feelings of despair and hopelessness around the climate crisis, and needed to have those scary feelings validated and a place to explore their implications and the evidence around what can help a person be resilient in the face of them and how these emotions are kind of value neutral. We don't need to be ashamed of them, and they actually carry information. And then with certain ways of approaching them and having practices, we can learn from those insights that they have to teach us, and they can actually motivate us and bring us into contact with more sustainable forms of change making that match our, the things that matter to us and our particular skills and the things that bring us joy. And we can do this together with other people. And like, there's a whole climate journey to go on if you find yourself at the pointy end of a distress spectrum. You don't need to stay there. You're not doomed to stay there. So, in that way, the book is marketed as science slash self-help. And when I got the when I got it back from the publisher the first time, I saw the thing, as a physical artifact, and I saw the genre on the back of psychological science and self-help. I was like, oh my God, did I write a self-help book? I did not mean to, but I understand the categorization. It's fair. It has some elements of that because it's, but it really, it's very mixed genre. It's pretty transdisciplinary. It's part sociological treatise. It's digging into the science, looking at psychiatry, public health, psychology, but also philosophy, and then lots of like tips and tricks of how people can and how people always have strengthened existential mindsets to be psychologically resilient, to take on the act of improving their conditions, even in the midst of tragedy, even when things are very, very hard. Because, humans, of course, have been doing that forever, especially those of us who are more marginalized. So, I mean, I was writing it to try and help people who were feeling very disenfranchised and not understood by the general culture in which these feelings are not allowed. We don't have social norms to process it, and therefore it can feel really alienating if you do try to talk about it, and then you're met with people who try to minimize it or belittle you or write it off as catastrophic thinking and just aren't really connecting with the pain of being alive to the climate crisis.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a fair statement that people are scared. And do you think that it's most recently, because I think as people get used to an idea, they adapt. We're obviously we have habits, and those habits can change you in different directions. If you have something that's tragic, it takes time, but you can form new habits to get over these type of things. Do you feel that people are more like, we know that we're scared, we know that there's a problem now, we've kind of accepted it, and that's obviously now causing all of this anxiety, but we're also causing, the entrepreneurs to kind of now like, okay, we got to do something about this now. We have to fix this. We have to change the ways. Like, where do you think we are? Are we in a worse place now when it comes to climate anxiety and that kind of thought versus where we were before?
So I think the anxiety is hyper useful in many ways. So the answer to your question, I would say, is like both yes on both. So it's there's more of an anxiety tremble out there in the public at large where people are more willing to talk about, yes, I have lost sleep because of my concerns about the climate crisis, thinking about it, what it means for my kids, or I get really pent up when the wildfire season starts, and I maybe I find it hard to get through those days when I'm like, wow, it's already this bad in 2024, but what does that mean looking ahead given climate projections and all that kind of very reasonable distress that people are struggling with, but also really hungry for ideas about how to cope effectively with it. And ideally, have it not just be, an emotional project, but something that can be harnessed for political change making and the kind of systems level transformation that we know that we need, that our best science tells us that we need across all sectors of society to safeguard our future on this planet. So that is all rising because we're seeing the disasters compound and collect, and more people being forced into becoming climate migrants, and all the things that if you're reading the reports is kind of clear as day. But at the same time, it comes with massive change making, social tipping points, people shaking off their complacency and stepping up and saying, wow, this is a really auspicious time to be alive. And what am I going to do with my precious time, resources, skills, my know-how? How can I be of use? And so we also simultaneously see this incredible, courageous wave of people being like, I'm going to make some uncomfortable changes. I'm not just going to accept the status quo. I'm not just going to do what I've been doing all these years when I can do something more purposeful to be of help. And so there's young people. We have polls showing that young graduates are willing to take pay cuts to work at organizations and companies that align with their climate values, for instance, as opposed to just working for those who are not addressing the problem, but giving them more money in their pocket. We've got lots of people on their own climate journey looking to transform their work and activities and volunteer approaches from what they're already doing to attach them in a new way towards climate solutions. And all of that is, it's not because people are feeling like the climate's in good shape, it's responding to a distress signal, a le certain level of concern and awareness that we're in real trouble, and so we need to deploy all the solutions that we can. And in that way, I really love this quote that comes from these researchers who were writing in The Lancet, a medical journal, about climate anxiety and grief. And they say at the end, like, recognizing that emotions are often what leads people to act, it is possible that feelings of ecological anxiety and grief, although uncomfortable, are in fact the crucible through which humanity must pass to harness the energy and conviction for the life-saving changes that are now required. And I think that that just really nicely encapsulates what I'm talking about, where, yeah, sure, there might be more distress, but there's more harnessing and using that distress as a super fuel for the kind of changes that we need to make. Because we're at a really interesting time in history, and when there is massive transformation underway, and you don't get that without a lot of discomfort within the human psyche. Like, we just don't change massive amounts of our ways of life if we're feeling comfortable. So yeah,
We need it.
we need it. And the question also is, like, how can we allow people to be in touch with that healthy part of the distress without impairing their functioning? Because it's only for some people that it becomes a mental health problem where it is creating, let's say, panic attacks or sleep problems, that sort of thing. But the research, which is now starting to collect, can show that, yeah, a lot of people feel climate anxiety, but without functional impairment. And it can be, and it's linked with pro-environmental behavior and action taking. So that's a good place to be.
Yeah, that is a kind of a non, it doesn't impair function, but it could empower change.
Right.
And I think that we are seeing it. And I think the part of the problem with climate as well is that it is climate. So you feel it, like you said, like wildfires and smoke and smelling it and surrounding, you can't see it, feels claustrophobic. Or you're a farmer and you lost your entire crop this year because of an unusual cold snap that now you're kind of looking at, are we going to get any fruit this year? Are we going to get any harvest this year? And so
Right.
you start to get those impacts. And then at the other side of, I've had conversations with people in a startup that just kind of was, they were talking about finances, and they said, oh, we were going to potentially go with a, a major bank, but that major bank, funds fossil fuels, so we've decided not to do that. And I was like, oh, and had nothing to do with climate, their business at all, but they, that was part of their discussion. And so you are starting to hear it. I guess the question too is, like, when it comes to the, an individual, but like when you think about, with the whole topic of greenwashing and businesses and, what's a good news solution, what you're doing and what you're not doing, and making people, worried about how they're saying this to either cause more anxiety or try to be optimistic. What's your thoughts on how kind of, either individuals or businesses really kind of communicate this type of things to help? Because you don't want to, I guess, you don't want to run a bunch of Super Bowl commercials dredging the fact that climate is even worse on people and making it worse for people that have climate anxiety, but you also want to hopefully have that message get people to make change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the thorns in the kind of corporate climate communications that we see the climate movement rightfully pushing back on is just that we get a lot of hopeful messaging that is making hope by declaring that said company, often fossil fuel company, is employing solutions and therefore on the right side of history and helping us get towards our climate goals, and within a kind of implicit message of don't worry, public, you don't need to be that rattled. Like, we're on the problem. We're using our muscle. We're deploying like biofuels and innovations in carbon capture and storage and all this stuff. And then if you dig into the reports, it's only what, 0.5% of their annual corporate expenditure that's being reinvested into these kinds of regenerative solutions. And so that huge gap between their power of influence in trying to get the public thinking certain things and then what they're doing on the ground is way out of alignment, and it's dishonest and inauthentic, especially as they continue pumping and extracting and, doing things that are going to burn more fossil fuels and break the carbon budget. So that's what certainly needs to be changed in a lot of organizational communication, more authentic, realistic ways of talking about, well, ideally boosting their actual activities to align more with what they want to say publicly. But also, we know, there's a bunch of cognitive psychology that shows that fear-based messaging, it is effective for some people to get you off the couch, to make you feel startled enough to do something, to reassess how you're living, and then strategize about ways to help solve the problem, mobilize some resources towards fending off the danger. We only feel climate anxiety because of care for what's in harm's way, right? It's a something that is compassionate and empathetic towards other people or other species or ecosystems. And so there's something that can be useful in storytelling by tapping into that, but we will get exhausted and burnt out if that's all that we see. It really it's not sustainable for the long term. It can create a crevice of despair and fatalism and a sense that the die is cast and we can't really address these overwhelming threats. So anything alarming needs to be immediately kind of followed up with active pathways that a person can get involved in or see other organizations and communities getting involved in. And it needs to have ways of boosting willpower and morale, right? Like courage, stories of how people have caused change historically in times of massive upheaval, social movements, big victories and wins for, let's say, abolishing slavery or giving women the vote or what have you. I mean, we're dealing with another massive moment of social change when it comes to becoming a climate safeguarding species based in trying to do that in this moment of capitalism, right? So that whole part I think is kind of missing about the courage that's needed for, or looking at World War II and what happened there to deploy solutions, lickety split. Like when you look at Seth Klein's book, A Good War, and how Canada responded, for instance, and he says that we need to bring that kind of mindset together now to solve this problem. We really don't see that one. I think it's a huge lost opportunity. And then the problem is, just telling people that there's hopeful stuff happening also isn't, it's missing the grit, it's missing the opportunity for courage and for people to get their own agency enacted and come together for collective efficacy and change making with others when it is just advertising that, hey, there's some things to feel optimistic about, because that's passive and it allows people to go back to sleep. And it doesn't connect with some of the dark underbelly of uncomfortable emotions that people might have cycling through them, so they end up feeling not spoken to. So it's a really complex question, but I'll just wrap that thought up with saying that, the psychology of hope has been studied, and it's not a feeling, it's not an emotion in the way that we typically think about it. It's not a passive wish that the future will be better than today. It actually requires three things, and it requires goals. So knowing what you're working for, having a clear vision. We need the storytelling and the narrative of like what better world we can actually build and that we're on track for, matched with pathways. So real viable pathways that we can get active on, that we can contribute our faculties towards to be part of active change making. And then thirdly, having that willpower, having enough gas in the tank. Sorry, bad metaphor. But having our cup be full enough so that we have something to give, so that we don't feel that, it's too late, so to speak, or that the die is cast in this situation. And those three things together then allow for that kind of active hope that really allows for the future to be genuinely better than it is today. But it requires that we roll up our sleeves and attach to those things. So if that could be embodied in so some more of our messaging, I think we'd be doing ourselves a much bigger service.
I think that's incredibly important. And if you're thinking about marketing messages and businesses that are trying to, and I think a lot of times companies feel or individuals feel like they're not maybe doing enough, or they're worried that the scrutiny of what they're going to be doing. But if you focus on what you said around the psychology of hope, around what are the goals that we want to achieve? Here are the things that we're going to do. Here are the things that we haven't done or figured out yet. And then following that up by constant action and what they're doing can showcase that, there is hope, and here's how we're doing it. And I think that's a really powerful message. When you think about your book, that obviously, it takes time and energy and thought and research to put together, and you think about the future of climate anxiety and, finding kind of purpose, which is what, you talk about in your book. Where do you hope that the book takes people in the next kind of 3 to 5 years? Like, what kind of outcome do you hope for that?
One thing that I found across so many fields, which is really heartening, is that one of the best things we can do to protect and promote mental health in times of adversity, such as climate disasters, and to deal also with the chronic stress and sense of insecurity that many people now feel because of the climate crisis, is to invest in our social relationships. It's to build strong, genuine community connections whereby we end up having a good level of what's called social capital. And that's the ability to achieve shared goals with other people, especially in the places where we live. And so that means that when the wildfire or the hurricane or the deadly heat wave does come through, people with high social capital and connectedness, time and again, the research will show they have statistically significantly lower levels of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, maladaptive coping with drugs or alcohol or you name it, than people who are more socially isolated and living in more fragmented kinds of communities and not able to rely on other people in those moments of acute stress or ongoing chronic stress. Because we build power and we share power, we allocate and we take resources from one another in these relational webs. And they're life-saving, but they're also mental health protecting and promoting. And by doing that kind of level work, heart-centered people work, we end up doing the most effective mental health intervention of all, but we never even have to call it mental health work. So you totally sidestep all the unfortunate stigma that often comes with that. And we boost our well-being, and we end up being more grateful on our deathbeds for the ways that we lived, because it's always relationships that people are focusing on, in that kind of deeper existential way, rather than, particular kinds of accomplishments and so on. And so I think that it's very hopeful to me that we can do that kind of preventative work from a public health inclusive community level perspective by being aware of that and employing that evidence in a very mindful way about how we sculpt and nurture our relationships. And then also we can have conversations about this rise of climate anxiety in our societies. We can make it validated, make people feel legitimized and safe to go there and do that in community, which helps to build those social relationships, and then plug into the resources which are now proliferating to help people when the distress becomes too much or a bit overwhelming or is really affecting well-being and quality of life, because now we've got climate-aware mental health professionals organized in places like the Climate Psychiatry Alliance, Climate Psychology Alliance, Climate Mental Health Network has all kinds of peer support resources. There's a variety of other providers to help respond to this, this real need that people are voicing to deal with climate anxiety. And the reason why we need to do this at the community level is that researchers and clinicians have stood up to argue that it's really not a pathology, it's not a mental disorder to have these concerns that are genuinely distressing, because it's a reasonable reaction to what's going on as our life support systems are threatened because of inaction. Instead, how do we help each other live well with this distress, learn from the insights, and harness it for that collective change? So it can be done with non-professionals often. It can be done with lay leaders and peer support workers and ways to kind of do some resilience training internally to help be better external change makers. So yeah, but I mean, there's so many different ways of looking at who the book supports. Frontline climate professionals who kind of are really bearing a psychological toll from professionally witnessing climate disruption day in, day out. That means, yes, the activists, the scientists, the green policymakers, the first responders, the climate journalists, and so on. And also prospective parents. It's really common now that people in my generation, millennials and Gen Z, are factoring climate change into big future planning questions, like, what family looks like and how to raise it, maybe in some ways that go beyond the imagining of the nuclear household, and also what it means to parent kids in a climate aware way, the most resiliently for the benefit of those kids, but also questions about career and like what kind of education to get and where to live and so on and so forth. So I hope that the book supports all those unfolding conversations people are starting to have.
I get it. I have three young kids, so and the oldest is in grade one, so it's they're not at that level of thought of what this all means yet. That it's yourself and myself. I do lots of research in climate. I get the benefit of also talking to a lot of incredible people that are doing things about it as well. And I often get the question of, do you feel optimistic or how do you feel about it? And it's always a hard one because of doing lots of research. You tend to go down the negative hole of understanding things, and then the positive side of obviously meeting a lot of incredible people doing really incredible work. And so you've obviously you're doing exactly that. And kind of as a last question as we wrap up, like what would you say to others that are kind of on that teeter-totter of career or that are thinking like what to do next, and maybe thought of getting into climate, and what would you say to them?
Well, there are so many great supports out there now because you are far from alone. Many are going through this process of internal reorganization for new external directions. And I would recommend places like All We Can Save. That was a best-selling book a few years ago that did so well that an organization was created on the back of it. It was a climate anthology. And they have a climate wayfinding course, which helps people find ways in which they can find their foothold in climate work that speaks to more than just the solutions that are available that they can throw themselves at, but really what is it that brings them joy? What gets them out of bed in the morning? What, makes them grateful to be alive? Because this work needs to be fun. It can't just be like broccoli, like doing something that's good for you, because you need to be doing it for the long haul, because that's what the world requires. As we're all moving on in the climate movement now, we need to find ways that it's personally sustainable. So let's make it fun. Let's also identify the skills that you uniquely possess because you've invested lots of time into cultivating them, let's say, or you're really naturally talented. Let's bring those in and overlap it with a deep understanding of climate emotions and ways that you might be processing this, so that it's most psychologically fortifying for you, and then attach it to all the solution spaces that need human energy at this time, and real work and committed people. So that's one resource. Another would be, you know, there's this community called My Climate Journey, and that has been largely explored by people coming from tech and other forms of entrepreneurship. And there, it's also about helping people kind of find their footing in this climate world when they've woken up to it and decided that they need to do something, but they don't exactly know where to start. There's lots of resources there. There's a Slack community. There's a podcast. There's community building. And then I would also recommend our newsletter, Gen Dread, which is about, it's a Substack, gendread.substack.com, where we share wide-ranging insights and expert advice and research and analyses on the intersection between climate and well-being.
Well, yeah, Brett, so and those are obviously, you know, very helpful. And I think I've never met a group of individuals that are working in climate that feels weirdly also like they're doing nonprofit work too, because they are so mission driven around, you know, finding change. And it's, you know, speaking to individuals like yourself, you can see the mix between, you know, the two sides of it, you know, a career plus also a mission to make change. And that's really, really incredible. And I say that's probably one of the commonalities that I've seen across, that it's just this really positive intermingle between the two different type of categories, and that's very exciting to see. So thank you. How can people find a little bit more around about yourself and find your book?
Well, thank you so much. And absolutely, I agree with everything you just said. I notice it day in, day out in this work, and it's super heartening, and it makes it a lot more fun to be in this space. So you can find out more about me at brittray.com. That's brittwray.com. My book is available there, Generation Dread. And also, we have a new nonprofit called Unthinkable, which is servicing in these areas related to everything we've discussed today. And that's at unthinkable.earth.
Britt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco. That was fun.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Someone Like You. We're a new podcast, and I would love if you can do a few things. One, please share the podcast with a friend, a family member, a work colleague, anybody that you can think of that would enjoy learning more about these incredible brands. Please also support these type of companies. They're doing the hard thing, and the hard thing often takes a lot of people to get on board. And don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I'm Marco Pimentel. Thank you for joining us today. For more information on Someone Like You, you can find us on Instagram at Someone Like You Podcast, with all the links to the podcast, our website, and more information about the brands that we feature. Thank you again.